stupendously, according to Who's Free. If it's me they wanted, they'd have to go about it differently. They're not going to burn down your warehouse on the off chance that I'll be called to investigate.
I suppose not, he said.
What about you? What's going on in your life aside from the divorce? He picked up a pencil and began to loop it through his fingers, end over end, like a tiny baton. He watched its progress, and then shot me an enigmatic look.
I have a sister who moved back here from Paris 3 months ago. Rumor has it she wants control of the plant.
Is this Ebony? He seemed surprised.
You know her?
Not well, but I know who she is.
She disapproves of the way I run things.
Enough to do this? He stared at me for a moment and then reached for the phone.
I better call my attorney.
You and me both, I said. I left and headed back into town. As far as I knew, the DA's office hadn't been notified and no charges had been filed. A valid arrest warrant has to be based on a complaint supported by facts showing, first of all, that a crime has been committed, and second, that the informer or his information is reliable. At this point, all Mac had was an anonymous telephone call and some circumstantial evidence. He'd have to take action. If the accusation was correct, then CF had to be protected. My guess was that he'd go back through my workload, case by case, to see if there was any whisper of misconduct on my part. He might also hire a private detective to look into the affairs of Wood Warren, Lance Wood, and possibly me. A novel idea. I wondered how my life would hold up if it were subjected to a professional scrutiny. The $5,000 would certainly come to light. I wasn't sure what to do about that. The deposit was damning in itself, but if I tried to move the money, it would look even worse. I remember the rest of the day in fragments. I talked to Lonnie Kingman, a criminal attorney I'd done some work for in the past. He's in his early 40s, with a face like a boxer, beetle-browed, broken nose. His hair is shaggy, and his suits usually look too tight across the shoulder blades. He's about 5'4" and probably weighs 205. He lifts weights at the same gym I do, and I see him in there doing squats with 300 pounds of plates wobbling on either end of the bar like water buckets. He graduated summa cum laude from Stanford Law School, and he wears silk shirts with his monogram on the cuff. Attorneys are the people who can say things in the mildest of tones that make you want to shriek and rend your clothes. Like doctors, they seem to feel obliged to acquaint you with the full extent of the horror you could face, given the current path your life is on. When I told him what was happening, he tossed out two possible additions to the allegation of insurance fraud: that I'd be named with Lance Wood as co-conspirator and charged as an aider and abettor to arson after the fact. And that was just what he came up with off the top of his head. I could feel myself pale. I don't want to hear this shit, I said. He shrugged. Well, it's what I'd go for if I were DA, he said offhandedly. I could probably add a few counts once I had all the facts. Facts, my ass! I never saw Lance Wood before in my life.
Sure, but can you prove it?
Of course not. How could I do that?
Lonnie sighed like he was going to hate to see me in a shapeless prison dress.
God damn it, Lonnie. How come the law always helps the other guy? I swear to God, every time I turn around, the bad guys win and the little guys bite the big weenie. What am I supposed to do?
He smiled. It's not as bad as all that, he said. My advice is to keep away from Lance Wood.
How? I can't just sit back and see what happens next. I want to know who set me up.
I never said you couldn't look into it. You're an investigator. Go investigate. But I'd be careful if I were you. Insurance fraud is bad enough. You don't want to take the rap for something worse.
I was afraid to ask him what he meant. I went home and unloaded the boxes full of office files. I took a few minutes to reword the message on my answering machine at home. I put a call through to Jonah Robb in missing persons at the Santa Teresa Police Department. As a lady in distress, I don't ordinarily call on men. I've been schooled in the notion that a woman these days saves herself, which I was willing to do if I could just figure out where to start. I'd met Jonah 6 months before while I was working on a case. Our paths had crossed more than once, most recently in my bed. He's 39, blunt, nurturing, funny, confused, a tormented man with blue eyes, black hair, and a wife named Camilla, who stalks out intermittently with his two little girls, whose names I repress. I had ignored the chemistry between us for as long as I could. Too wise, said I, to get pulled into a dalliance with a married gent. And then one rainy night I'd run into him on my way home from a depressing interview with a hostile subject. Jonah and I started drinking margaritas in a bar near the beach. We danced to old Johnny Mathis tunes, talked, danced again, and ordered more drinks. Somewhere around the 12th of Never, I lost track of my resolve and took him home with me. I never could resist the lyrics on that one. We were currently at that stage in a new relationship where both parties are tentative, reluctant to presume, quick to feel injured, eager to know and be known as long as the true frailties of character are concealed. The risking felt good, and as a consequence, the chemistry felt good, too. I smiled a lot when I thought of him, and sometimes I laughed aloud, but the warmth was undercut by a curious pain. I've been married twice, done in more times than I care to admit. I'm not as trusting as I used to be, and with good reason. Meanwhile, Jonah was in a constant state of upheaval according to the fluctuations in Camilla's moods. Her most recent claim was that she wanted an open marriage, his guess being that the sexual liberties were intended more for her than for him.
Missing persons, Sergeant Shipman.
For an instant, my mind went absolutely blank. Rudy? This is Kinsey. Where's Jonah?
Oh, hi, Kinsey. He's out of town. Took his family skiing for the holidays. It came up kind of sudden, but I thought he said he'd let you know. He never called?
I guess not, I said. Do you know when he's expected back?
Just a minute, let me check.
He put me on hold, and I listened to the Norman Luboff choir singing Hark the Herald Angels Sing. Christmas was over. Hadn't anybody heard? Rudy clicked back in.
Looks like January 3rd. You want to leave a message?
Tell him I hung myself, I said, and rang off. I have to confess that in the privacy of my own home, I burst into tears and wept with frustration for 6 minutes flat. Then I went to work. The only line of attack I could think of was through Ash Wood. I hadn't spoken to her since high school, nearly 14 years. I tried the directory. Her mother, Helen Wood, was listed, and so was Lance, but there was no sign of Ash, which probably meant that she'd moved away or married. I tried the main house. A woman answered. I identified myself and told her I was trying to locate Ash. Often I tell lies in a situation like this, but the truth seemed expedient.
Kinsey, is that really you? This is Ash. How are you? She said.
All the Wood girls have voices that sound the same, husky and low, underlaid with an accent nearly southern in its tone. The inflection was distinct, not a drawl, but an indolence. Their mother was from Alabama, if my memory hadn't failed me.
I can't believe my luck, I said. How are you?
Well, darling, we are in a world of hurt, she replied.
Which is why I'm so glad to hear from you. Lance mentioned that he'd seen you at the plant last Friday. What's happening?
That's what I called to ask you.
Oh, Lord, I'd love to bring you up to date. Are you free for lunch by any chance?
For you, anything, I said.
She suggested the Edgewater Hotel at 12:30, which suited me. I'd have to change clothes first. My standard outfit consists of boots or tennis shoes, form-fitting jeans, and a tank top or a turtleneck, depending on the season. Sometimes I wear a windbreaker or a denim vest, and I've always got a large leather shoulder bag, which sometimes, but not often, contains my little 32. I was relatively certain Ashley wouldn't appear in public like this. I hold out my all-purpose dress, pantyhose, and low heels. One day soon, I gotta get myself something else to wear.
End of Disc 1. Disc 2.
Chapter 5. The Edgewater Hotel sits on 23 acres of oceanfront property, with lawns sweeping down to the sea. An access road cuts through, not 10 feet from the surf, with a seawall constructed of local sandstone. The architecture of the main building is Spanish, with massive white stucco walls, arched doorways, and deeply recessed windows. Horizontal lines of red tile define the roof. A glass-walled dining patio juts out in front, white umbrella tables sheltering the patrons from sunlight and buffeting sea winds. The grounds are landscaped with juniper and palm, hibiscus, bottle brush, and fern. Flower beds filled year-round with gaudy annuals in hot pink, purple, and gold. The day was chill, the sky icy white and overcast. The drab olive-green surf was churned up by the outer fringes of a storm system that had passed us to the north. The valet parking attendant was far too discreet to remark, even with a look, the battered state of my ancient car. I moved into the hotel lobby and down a wide corridor furnished with a series of overstuffed couches, interspersed with rubber plants. The ceiling overhead was wood-beamed, the walls tiled halfway up, sounds muffled by a runner of thick carpet patterned with flowers the size of dinner plates. Ash had reserved a table in the main dining room. She was already seated, her face turned expectantly toward me as I approached. She looked much as she had in high school, pale red hair, blue eyes set in a wide, friendly face, mottled with freckles. Her teeth were very white and straight, and her smile was engaging. I had forgotten how casually she dressed. She was wearing a blue wool jumpsuit with a military cut, and over it a bulky white sheepskin vest. I thought with regret of my jeans and turtleneck. She was still maybe 20 pounds overweight, and she moved with all the enthusiasm of an ungainly pup, leaping up to hug me when I arrived at the table. There had always been a guileless quality about her. Despite the fact she came from money, she had never been snobbish or affected. Where Olive had seemed reserved and Ebony intimidating, Ash seemed utterly unself-conscious, one of those girls everybody liked. In our sophomore year, we had ended up sitting in adjoining homeroom seats, and we'd often chatted companionably before classes began. Neither of us was a cheerleader, an honor student, or a candidate for prom queen. The friendship that sprang up between us, though genuine, was short-lived. I met her family, she met my aunt. I went to her house and thereafter neatly bypassed her coming to mine. While the Woods were always gracious to me, it was obvious that Ash functioned at the top of the social heap, and I at the bottom. Eventually, the disparity made me so uncomfortable that I let the contact lapse. If Ash was injured by the rejection, she did a good job of covering it. I felt guilty about her anyway, and was relieved the next year when she sat somewhere else. "Kinsey, you look great. I'm so glad you called. I ordered us a bottle of Chardonnay. I hope that's okay." "Fine," I said, smiling. "You look just the same." "Big rump, you mean," she said with a laugh. "You're just as thin as you always were, only I half expected you to show up in jeans. I don't believe I ever saw you in a dress." "I thought I'd act like I had some class," I said. "How are you? When I didn't find you listed in the phone book, I thought you'd probably gotten married or left town." "Actually, I've been gone for 10 years and just got back. What about you? I can't believe you're a private detective. I always figured you'd end up in jail. You were such a rebel back then." I laughed. I was a misfit in high school and hung out with guys known as low wallers because they loitered along a low wall at the far end of the school grounds. "You remember Donan, the boy with the gold tooth who sat right in front of you in homeroom? He's an OBGYN in town. Got his teeth fixed and went to med school." Ash groaned, laughing. "God, that's one way to get your hand up a girl's skirt. What about the little swarthy one who sat next to you? He was funny. I liked him." "He's still around, bald now and overweight. He runs a liquor store up on the bluffs." "Who was that girlfriend of yours who used to shoplift? Francesca something?" "Palmer. She's living with a fellow in Santa Fe who designs furniture. I saw her about a year ago when I was passing through." "God, she's still a klepto. Are you married?" "Was." I held up two fingers to indicate the number of husbands who had come and gone. "Children?" she asked. "Oh, God, no, not me. You have any?" "Sometimes I wish I did." Ash was watching me with shining eyes, and somehow I knew anything I said would be fine with her. "When did we see each other last? It's been years, hasn't it?" I asked. She nodded. "Bass's 21st birthday party at the country club. You were with the most beautiful boy I ever saw in my life." "Daniel," I said. "He was husband number 2. "What about number 1? What was he like?" "I better drink some first." The waiter appeared with the wine, presenting the label for her inspection before he opened it. She waved aside the ritual of the sniffing of the cork and let him go ahead and pour for both of us. I noticed that the waiter was smiling to himself, probably charmed, as most people are, by Ash's breezy manner and her impatience with formality. He was tall and slim, maybe 26 years old, and he told us about the specials as if we might want to take notes.
The sea bass is being served today with a green chili beurre blanc, gently poached first with fresh tomatoes, cilantro, lemon, and white wine, garnished with jalapenos and accompanied by a pine nut rice pilau. We are also offering a fillet of coho salmon.
Ash made little mewing sounds, interrupting now and then for clarification of some culinary subtlety. I let her order for us. She knew all the waiters by name, and ended up in a long chat with ours about what we should eat. She settled on steamed clams in a broth with Pernod, a salad of field greens lightly dressed, and said we'd think about dessert if we were good girls and cleaned our plates. While we ate, I told her about my connection to Wood Warren and the irregularities that had come to light.
"Oh, Kinsey, I feel awful. I hope Lance isn't responsible for the trouble you're in."
"Believe me, I do, too. What's the story on him? Is he the type to burn down the family warehouse?" Ash didn't leap to his defense as I'd expected her to.
"If he did, I don't think he'd snitch on himself," she said.
"Good point. Who'd go after him like that?"
"I don't know. The whole situation got very screwed up once Daddy died. He was crazy about the boys, but Bass was a dilettante, and Lance raised hell half the time."
"I seem to remember that. Your father must have had conniption fits."
"Oh, he did. You know how straight he was.
Daddy had real strong ideas about parenting, but most of them were wrong. He had no idea how to implement them anyway. He wanted to control and mold and dominate, but he couldn't even do that very well. Kids just don't behave like company employees. Daddy thought he'd have more control at home, but the truth was he had less. Both Lance and Bass were determined to thwart him. Bass never has straightened out."
"He's still in New York?"
"Oh, he comes home now and then. He was here for a week at Thanksgiving. But for the most part, he's gone. New York, Boston, London. He spent a year in Italy and swears he's going back.
Much as I love him, he's a waste of time. I don't think he's ever going to get his act together. Of course, Lance was that way for years. They're both smart enough, but they always partied hard, and Lance had a few scrapes with the law. It drove Daddy up the wall."
The clams arrived. Each of us was presented with a plate piled high with small, perfect shells, swaddled in cloth to keep the broth piping hot. She speared a tender button of clam flesh and placed it on her tongue, her eyes closing in a near swoon as she swallowed. I watched her butter a crescent of French bread and dip it in the bowl, sopping up clam liquor. As she bit into it, she made a little sound low in her throat, like something out of an X-rated video.
"Your lunch okay?" I asked dryly.
"Fine," she said.
"Good." She realized belatedly that I was teasing her, and she smiled, her cheeks tinted becomingly with pink.
"Someone asked me once which I'd rather have, sex or a warm chocolate chip cookie. I still can't decide."
"Go for the cookies. You can bake 'em yourself."
She wiped her mouth and took a sip of wine.
"Anyway, about the last 6 or 7 years, Lance took hold, more or less, and started showing an interest in the business. Daddy was thrilled. Wood Warren was Daddy's life. He loved us, but he couldn't manage us the way he did the business. By the time Bass came along, the last in line, Daddy'd pretty much given up any hopes for a successor."
"What about Ebony?"
"Oh, she's been passionate about the company since she was a kid, but she didn't believe Daddy'd ever let her have a hand in it. He was old-fashioned. A man leaves his business to his oldest son, period. He knew Ebony was smart, but he didn't think she was tough enough, and he didn't think she'd stay with it. Women get married and have babies and spend money. That was his attitude. Women join the country club and play tennis and golf. They don't go head-to-head with chemical engineers and systems analysts."
She even went off to Cal Poly and started working on an engineering degree. But Daddy made it clear it wouldn't help her cause, so she went to Europe and got married instead.
Thus fulfilling his prophecy, I said.
"That's right.
Of course, at that point, Daddy did a turnaround and swore he'd have left her the company if she'd stuck it out. She hated him for that, and I didn't blame her a bit. He was a real shit sometimes."
"She's back now, isn't she?"
"Right. She got home in August, minus Julian, which is no big loss. He was a dud if I ever saw one. A real bore. I don't know how she put up with him.
Lance says she wants to take over.
I've heard that, too, though it's not anything she talks to me about. I get along with Ebony, but we're not real close.
What about Olive? Is she interested?
Peripherally, I guess. She married one of the chemical engineers who worked for Daddy. He's vice president now, but they met when she was still in college, and he'd just hired on.
Is that Terry Kohler?
She nodded.
You met him?
When I was out there. What's he like?
Oh, I don't know. Smart, moody, intense. Pleasant enough, but sort of humorless.
Good at what he does.
Crazy about her, I must say. He worships the ground she walks on. Slavish is the word.
Lucky girl. Is he ambitious?
He used to be. He wanted to go out on his own at one point and form his own company, but I guess it didn't work out. He kind of lost heart after that, and I don't know. Being married to the boss's daughter probably takes the heat off.
How does he get along with Lance?
They clash now and then. Terry's easily offended. You know the type. He gets his nose bent out of shape at the least little thing.
What about John Salkowitz?
He's a sweetie. He's what Daddy wanted Lance to be.
You said Lance had a couple of scrapes with the law. What was that about?
He stole some things from the plant.
Really? When was this?
In high school. He came up with a scheme to make some money, but it didn't work out. It was part of an economics class, and I guess his grade depended on how well he did. When he realized his little enterprise was failing, he stole some equipment. Nothing big, but he tried to sell it to a fence. The guy got uneasy and called the cops.
Not too smart.
That's what pissed Daddy off, I suspect.
Did he press charges?
Are you kidding?
Of course. He said that was the only way Lance would ever learn.
And did he?
Well, he got in trouble again, if that's what you mean.
Lots of times. Daddy finally threw his hands up and sent him off to boarding school.
The subject veered off. We finished lunch, chatting about other things. At 2 o'clock, Ash glanced at her watch.
Oh, Lord, I've got to go. I promised Mother I'd take her shopping this afternoon.
Come along if you like. I know she'd love to see you. She signaled for the check. I better take care of some other business first, but I do want to talk to her.
Give us a call and come up to the house.
Are you living there now?
Temporarily. I just bought a place of my own, and I'm having some work done. I'll be staying with Mother for another 6 weeks.
When the check arrived, I reached for my handbag, but she waved me off.
I'll take care of it. I'll claim it as a business lunch and charge it off to the company. It's the least I can do with the bind you're in.
Thanks, I said. I got Ebony's personal telephone number from her, and we walked out together. I was relieved that the valet service brought her car first. I watched her pull away in a little red Alfa Romeo. My car appeared. I tipped the fellow more than I should have and got in with care, humping myself onto the seat to avoid snagging my pantyhose behind the knee. The valet slammed the door and I turned the key.
Honest to God, it started right up, and I felt a surge of pride.
The damn thing is paid for and only costs me $10 a week in gas. I drove home and let myself in the gate, steadfastly disregarding the yawning air of emptiness about the place. The winter grass seemed ragged, and the deadheads on the zinnias and marigolds had multiplied. Henry's house stood silent, his back door looking blank. Usually the scent of yeast or cinnamon lies on the air like a heady perfume. Henry's a retired commercial banker who can't quite give up his passion for kneading dough and proofing bread. If he isn't in the kitchen, I can usually find him on the patio, weeding the flower beds, or stretched out on a chaise, inventing crossword puzzles filled with convoluted puns. I let myself into my apartment and changed back into jeans, my whole body sighing with relief. I hauled the mower out of the tool shed and had a run at the yard, and then I got down on my hands and knees and clipped all the dead blossoms from the beds. This was very boring. I put the lawnmower away. I went inside and typed up my notes. As long as I was investigating in my own behalf, I decided to do it properly. This was boring, too. Since Rosie's was closed, I ate dinner at home, preparing a cheese and pickle sandwich, which entertained me no end. I'd finished the Len Dayton, and I didn't have anything else in the house to read, so I switched on my little portable television set. Sometimes I wonder if my personal resources aren't wearing a little thin. Chapter 6 Tuesday morning, I went into the gym at 6 o'clock a.m. As I no longer had an office to go to, I could well have waited until later in the morning. But I like the place at that hour. It's quiet and half-empty, so there's no competition for equipment. The free weights are neatly re-racked, the mirrors are clean, and the air doesn't smell like yesterday's sweat socks. Weightlifting apparatus are a curious phenomenon. Machines invented to replicate the back-breaking manual labor the Industrial Revolution relieved us of. Lifting weights is like a meditation. Intermittent periods of concentrated activity with intervals of rest. It's a good time for thinking, as one can do little else. I did ab crunches first, 35, then 30, then 25. I adjusted the bench on one of the Nautilus machines and started doing seated military presses. 3 sets, 10 reps each, using 2 plates. The guys lift anywhere from 10 to 20 plates, but I work just as hard, and I'm not really preparing for the regional bodybuilding championship. I was thinking back over the details of the frame-up. A clever piece of work, dependent on a number of events coming together just as they had. The phone call to Mac must have come from Ava Doherty, but who put her up to it? Surely she didn't cook up that trouble by herself. Someone had access to the Wood Warren file, and while it was possible that the office keys had been lifted from my bag, who at Wood Warren knew enough to make a mock-up of a fire department report? That must have been done by someone who knew the procedure at CF. Insurance investigations usually follow a format. An outsider simply couldn't guarantee that all the paper switching could be done in the necessary sequence. Darcy could have managed it. Andy might have, or even Mac. But why? I work through biceps and triceps. Since I jog 6 days a week, my prime interest in the gym is the 3 A's, arms, abs, and ass, a routine that takes 45 minutes 3 times a week. I was finished by 7:15. I went home to shower, and then I started out again, dressed in jeans, turtleneck, and boots. Darcy was due at work at 9 o'clock, but I'd spotted her 3 days out of 5 having breakfast first, coffee and a Danish in the coffee shop across the street. She used the time to chit-chat, read the newspaper, and do her nails. There was no sign of her when I got there at 8 o'clock. I bought a paper and settled into the back booth where she usually sits. Claudine came by, and I ordered breakfast. At 8:12, Darcy came through the door in a lightweight wool coat. She stopped when she saw me, checked her stride, and slid into an empty booth halfway down. I picked up my coffee cup and joined her, loving the sour look that crossed her face when she realized what I was up to. "Mind if I join you?" I asked.
"Well, actually, I'd prefer to have the time to myself," she said, avoiding my gaze.
Claudine arrived with a steaming plate of bacon and scrambled eggs, which she set down in front of me. Claudine is in her 50s, with a booming voice and calves knotted with varicose veins.
"Morning, Darcy. What'll you have today? We're out of cheese Danish, but I laid back a cherry in case you're interested."
"That's fine, and a small orange juice."
Claudine made a note and tucked her order pad in her apron pocket.
"Just a second, and I'll bring you a coffee cup."
She was gone again before Darcy could protest. I could see her do a quick visual survey, looking for an empty seat. The place was filling up rapidly, and it looked like she was trapped. While I ate, I studied her in a manner that I hoped was disconcerting. She eased out of her coat, making a big deal out of standing up so she could fold it just so. She's one of those women a glamour magazine should make over as a challenge to their in-house experts. She has baby-fine hair that defies styling, a high bulging forehead, pale blue eyes. Her skin is milky white and translucent, with a tracery of veins showing through like faded laundry marks. I'd heard Darcy's boyfriend was a mail carrier, dealing drugs on the side, and I wondered if he delivered junk mail and junk on the same run. I could tell I was ruining her day, which improved my appetite. "I'm assuming you heard about the trouble I'm in."
"It'd be hard not to," she said.
I opened a plastic locket of grape jelly and spread half on a triangle of whole wheat toast. "Got any ideas about who set me up?" Claudine returned with a cup and saucer and the coffee pot. Darcy judiciously elected to refrain from comment until her cup was filled and mine had been topped off. When Claudine departed, Darcy's expression turned prim, and her coloring altered like a mood ring, shifting down a grade from woeful to glum. Actually, the change was not unappealing. She's big on pastel shades, imagining, I suppose, that washed-out colors are somehow more flattering to her than bold ones. She wore a pale yellow sweater about the hue of certain urine samples I've seen where the prognosis isn't keen. The pink in her cheeks gave her back an air of health. She leaned forward.
"I didn't do anything to you," she said.
"Great, then maybe you can help."
"Mac told us specifically not to talk to you."
"How come?"
"Well, obviously he doesn't want you to get information you're not supposed to have."
"Such as?"
"I'm not going to discuss it with you."
"Why don't I tell you my theory?" I said sociably.
I half expected her to stick her fingers in her ears and start singing aloud to drown me out, but I noticed that she was not completely uninterested, and I took heart from that.
"I suspect maybe Andy's at the bottom of this. I don't know what he's getting out of it, but it's probably some form of financial gain. Maybe somebody's throwing business his way, or giving him a kickback. Of course, it crossed my mind that it might be you, but I don't really think so at this point. I think if you'd done it, you'd be friendly, to convince me of your goodwill, if nothing else." Darcy opened a paper sugar packet and measured out half a teaspoon, which she stirred into her coffee. I went right on, talking aloud as if she were a pal of mine and meant to help. "CF hires other outside investigators, so I'm imagining that any one of us could have been implicated. It was just my dumb luck that I was up at bat. Not that Andy wouldn't take a certain satisfaction from the fact. He's never been fond of me, and he always hated it that Mac let me have office space. Andy wanted to knock the wall out and take that corner for himself. At any rate, I have to assume Lance Wood is the real focus of the frame, though I don't know why yet. What I'll probably do is try working both sides of the street here and just see where all the paths intersect. Should be fun. I've never worked for me before, and I'm looking forward to it. Cuts down on the paperwork." I checked her reaction. Those pale eyes were focused on mine, and I could see that her mental gears were engaged. "Come on, Darcy, help me out," I coaxed. "What do you have to lose?"
"You don't even like me."
"You don't like me either. What's that got to do with it? We both hate Andy. That's the point. The guy's a shitheel."
"Actually, he is," she said.
"You don't think Mac had anything to do with it, do you?"
"Well, no."
"So who else could it be?"
She cleared her throat. "Andy has been hanging around my desk a lot."
Her voice was so low I had to lean forward. "Go on."
"It started the day Jewel left on vacation, and Mac told him to farm out her work. Andy was the one who suggested you for the Wood Warren fire claim."
"He probably thought it'd be easier to pressure me." Claudine brought Darcy's OJ and the cherry Danish. Darcy broke the Danish into small pieces, buttering each with care before she popped it in her mouth. "Jesus, maybe I'd have one."
She was just warming up on the subject of Andy Motika, who was apparently no fonder of her than he was of me. "What irritates me," she said, "is that I got in trouble with Mac because Andy said the file sat on my desk for 3 days before it got to you. That's an outright lie. Andy took it home with him. I saw him put it in his briefcase Tuesday when the fire department report came in."
"Did you tell Mac that?"
"Well, no. Why bother? It sounds like I'm trying to defend myself by pushing all the blame off on him."
"You're right. I found myself in the same position," I said.
"Look, if Andy falsified the fire department report, he probably did the dirty work at home, don't you think?"
"Probably." "So maybe we can turn up some proof if we look. I'll nose around at his place if you'll try his office."
"He moved, you know. He's not at the house. He and Janice are in the process of splitting up."
"He's getting divorced?"
"Oh, sure. It's been going on for months. She's hosing him, too."
"Really? Well, that's interesting. Where's he living?"
"One of those condos out near Sandcastle."
I'd seen the complex. 160 units across from a public golf course called Sandcastle, out beyond Colgate in the little community of Elton. "What about his office? Is there any way you could check that out?"
Darcy smiled for the first time. "Sure, I'll do that. It would serve him right."
I got her home number and said I'd call later. I paid both checks and took off, figuring it wouldn't be a good idea to get caught in Darcy's company. While I was downtown, I hoofed it over to the credit bureau and had a discreet chat with a friend of mine who works as a key punch operator. I'd done some work for her years before, checking into the background of a certain seedy gent who had hoped to relieve her of a burdensome savings account. She'd had the bucks in hand to pay me, but I sensed that both of us would benefit from a little bartering.
professional courtesies as they're known. Now I check out any new fellow in her life, and in return she pirates occasional confirmation copies of computer runs. One drawback is that I have to wait until a periodic updating of the master file is scheduled, which usually happens once a week. I asked her to give me anything she had on Lance Wood, and she promised me something in a day. On an impulse, I asked her to check out Andy Motika while she was at it. Financial information on Wood Warren I'd have to get from the local equivalent of Dun and Bradstreet. My best source of information was going to be California Fidelity itself, for whom Lance Wood had no doubt filled out countless forms in applying for coverage. I was hoping I could enlist Darcy's aid again on that one. It was amazing to me how much more appealing she seemed now that she was on my team. I trotted back to pick up my car. As I pulled out of the parking lot behind the building, Andy was just pulling in, pausing while the machine stamped and spat a ticket through the slot. He pretended he didn't see me. I drove back to my apartment. I'd never paid much attention to the looming importance of the office in my life. I conduct maybe 40% of all business in my swivel chair, telephone in the crook of my neck, files close at hand. 60% of the time I'm probably on the road, but I don't like feeling cut off from my reference points. It puts me at a subtle disadvantage. It was only 10:05, and the day loomed ahead. Out of habit, I hauled out my little portable Smith Corona and started typing up my notes. That done, I caught up with some filing, prepared some bills for a couple of outstanding accounts, and then tidied up my desk. I hate sitting around, especially when I could be out getting into trouble. I gave Darcy a call at CF and got Andy's new address and telephone number. She assured me he was sitting in his office even as we spoke. I dialed his apartment and was reassured to hear the answering machine pick up. I changed into a pair of blue-gray slacks with a pale stripe along the seam and a matching pale blue shirt with Southern California services stitched around a patch on the sleeve. I added hard black shoes left over from my days on traffic detail with the Santa Teresa Police Department, tacked on a self-important key ring with a long chain, and grabbed up a clipboard, my key picks, and a set of master keys. I checked myself out in the mirror. I looked like a uniformed public servant just about to make a routine service check. Of what, I wasn't sure. I looked like I could read meters and make important notes. I looked like I could verify downed lines and order up repair crews on the mobile phone in my county-owned maintenance vehicle. I hopped in my car and headed out to Andy's condominium for a little B&E. Chapter 7 The Cops at Hurstbourne is one of those fancy-sounding titles for a brand-new tract of condominiums on the outskirts of town. Cops, as in a thicket of small trees. Hurst, as in hillock, knoll, or mound. And burn, as in brook or stream. All of these geological and botanical wonders did seem to conjoin within the 20 parcels of the development, but it was hard to understand why it couldn't have just been called Shady Acres, which is what it was. Apparently, people aren't willing to pay $150,000 for a home that doesn't sound like it's part of an Anglo-Saxon land grant. These often quite utilitarian dwellings are never named after Jews or Mexicans. Try marketing Rancho Feinstein if you want to lose money in a hurry. Or Paco Sanchez Park. Middle-class Americans aspire to tone, which is equated absurdly with the British gentry. I had already passed Essex Hill, Stratford Heights, and Hampton Ridge. The Copse at Hurstbourne was surrounded by a high wall of fieldstone, with an electronic gate meant to keep the riffraff out. The residents were listed on a mounted panel beside a telephone handset with push buttons and an intercom. Each occupant was assigned a personal entry code that one had to have in order to gain admittance. I know because I tried several sequences at random and got nowhere. I pulled over and waited until another car approached. The driver punched in his code. When the gate rolled back, I tucked my car in behind his and sailed through. No alarms went off. I wasn't set upon by dogs. Security measures like the property's pedigree were largely in the minds of the marketing team. There were maybe 20 buildings in all, 8 units each, gray frame with white trim in a Cape Cod style, all angles, mullioned windows, and wooden balconies. Sycamore and eucalyptus trees still graced the terrain. Winding roads led in two directions, but it was clear that both came together in the same rear parking lot rimmed with carports.
I found a visitor's space and pulled in, checking the building directory, which sported a plot map of units. Andy Motika's was number 364, located happily at the far reaches of the property. I took my clipboard and flashlight and tried to look as officious as I could. I passed the recreational facility, the spa, the laundry rooms, the gym, and the sales office. There were no signs of children. Judging from the number of empty carports, my guess was that many of the residents were off at work somewhere else. Wonderful. A band of thugs could probably sweep through and clean the place out in half a day. I moved around some Cape Cod-style garbage bins and went up a set of outside stairs to the second floor of building number 18. The landing of the apartment next door to Andy's was attractively furnished with shoulder-high ficus and assorted potted plants. Andy's porchlet was bare, not even a doormat. The drapes were open, and there were no interior lights on. No sound of a television set, stereo, or toilets flushing. I rang the bell. I waited a decent interval, easing back slightly so I could check for tenants on either side. No signs of activity. It looked like I had the building to myself. The front door lock was a Weiss. I sorted through my key picks and tried one or two without luck. Picking a lock is time-consuming shit, and I didn't feel I could stand out there indefinitely. Someone might pass and wonder why I was jiggling that length of thin metal in the keyhole and cursing mildly to myself. On an impulse, I raised my hand and felt along the top of the door jamb. Andy'd left me his key. I let myself in. I dearly love being in places I'm not supposed to be. I can empathize with cat burglars, housebreakers, and second-story men, experiencing, as I've heard some do, adrenaline raised to a nearly sexual pitch. My heart was thudding, and I felt extraordinarily alert. I did a quick walking survey, eyeballing the two bedrooms, walk-in closets, and both bathrooms, just to determine that no one was tossing the apartment but me. In the master bedroom, I opened the sliding glass door and the screen. I went out on the balcony that connected the two bedrooms and devised an escape route in case Andy came home unexpectedly. Against the side wall, around the corner to the right, was an ornamental trellis with a newly planted bougainvillea at its base. In a pinch, I could scamper down like an orangutan and disappear. I eased back into the apartment and began my search. Andy's bedroom floor was densely matted with dirty clothes, through which a narrow path had been cleared. I picked my way past socks, dress shirts, and boxer shorts in a variety of vulgar prints. In lieu of a chest of drawers, he kept his clean clothes in four dark blue plastic stacking crates. His newfound bachelorhood must be taking him back to his college days. None of the bins contained anything of interest. I spent 15 minutes sliding my hand into all the coat pockets on his hanging rod, but all I came up with were some woofies, a handkerchief full of old boogers, and a ticket for a batch of cleaning he hadn't yet retrieved. The second bedroom was smaller. Andy's bicycle was propped against one wall, the back tire flat. He had a rowing machine, 8 cardboard moving boxes, unlabeled and still taped shut. I wondered how long he'd been separated. I'd met Andy's wife, Janice, at a couple of California Fidelity office parties and hadn't thought much of her until I saw what she'd left him with. The lady had really done a thorough shakedown. Andy had always complained about her extravagance, making sure we all knew she shopped at the best stores in town. It was a measure of his success, of course, that she could charge with impunity. What was clear now was that she played for keeps. Andy'd been granted a card table, 4 aluminum lawn chairs with webbed seats, a mattress, and some flatware with what must have been his mother's monogram. It looked like Janice had been sticking it in the dishwasher for years because the finish was dull and the silver plate was worn off the handles. The kitchen cabinets held paper plates and insulated cups, along with a sorry assortment of canned goods. This guy ate worse than I did. Since the condos were brand new, the appliances were up to date and immaculate. Self-cleaning oven, big refrigerator, empty except for 2 6-packs of no-brand beer. With an ice maker clattering away, dishwasher, microwave, disposal, trash compactor. The freezer was stacked with cartons of lean cuisine. He favored spaghetti and chicken cacciatore. A bottle of aquavit lay on its side, and he had a bag of frozen hard rock, Milky Way bars that were just an invitation to break off a tooth. The dining area was actually a simple extension of the small living room, the kitchen separated by a pass-through with bifold shutters painted white. There was very little in the way of furnishings. The card table seemed to double as dining room table and home office.
The telephone sat there, plugged into the answering machine, which showed no messages. The surface was littered with typing supplies, but there was no typewriter in sight. His bottle of whiteout was getting as sluggish as old nail polish. The wastebasket was empty. I went back into the kitchen and slid open the compactor, which was loosely packed but full. Gingerly, I rooted through, spotting crumpled sheets of paper about three layers down. I removed the liner and inserted a fresh one. I doubted Andy would remember whether he'd emptied his trash or not. He'd probably spent most of his married life being waited on hand and foot, and my guess was he took household chores for granted, as if the elves and fairies crept in at night and cleaned pee off the rim of the toilet bowl whenever he missed. I glanced at my watch. I'd been in the place 35 minutes, and I didn't want to press my luck. I closed and locked the sliding glass door again, made a final pass to see if I'd overlooked anything, and then let myself out the front, taking his trash bag with me. By noon I was home again, sitting on Henry's back patio with Andy's garbage spread around me like a beggar's picnic. Actually, the debris was fairly benign, and didn't make me feel I needed a tetanus booster just to sort through. He was heavy into pickles, olives, anchovies, jalapeno peppers, and other foodstuffs in which no germs could live. There were no coffee grounds or orange peels, no evidence whatever that he ate anything fresh. Lots of beer cans. There were 6 plastic Lean Cuisine pouches, layers of junk mail, 6 dunning notices rimmed in red or pink, a notice of a Toastmaster's roast of a local businessman, a flyer from a car wash, and a letter from Janice that must have left him incensed, as he had crumpled it into a tiny ball and bitten down on it. I could see the perfect impression of his teeth in the wadded paper. She was bugging him about a temporary support check that was late again, said she, underlined twice and bracketed with exclamation points. At the bottom of the bag was the back end of a pad of checks, deposit slip still attached, with the name of Andy's bank and his checking account number neatly printed thereon. I saved that for future reference. I had set aside the crumpled papers that were shoved into the bag halfway down. I smoothed them out now. 6 versions of a letter to someone he referred to variously as Angel, Beloved, Light of My Life, My Darling, and Dearest One. He seemed to remember her anatomy in loving detail without much attention to her intellect. Her sexual enthusiasms still had him all aflame and had thus apparently impaired his typing skills. Lots of strikeovers in the lines where he reviewed their time together, which I gathered was on or about Christmas Eve. In recalling the experience, he seemed to struggle with a paucity of adjectives, but the verbs were clear enough. "Well, Andy, you old devil," I murmured to myself. He said he longed to have her suckle the something-something from his XXXXXXXX, all crossed out. My guess was that it was related to flower parts and that his botanical knowledge had failed him. Either that, or the very idea had caused emotional dyslexia. Also, he couldn't quite decide what tone to take. He vacillated somewhere between groveling and reverential. He said several things about her breasts that made me wonder if she might benefit from surgical reduction. It was embarrassing reading, but I tried not to shrink from my responsibilities. Having finished, I made a neat packet of all the papers. I'd make a separate holding file for them until I could decide if any might be of use. I shoved the trash back in the bag and tossed it in Henry's garbage can. I let myself into my apartment and checked my answering machine. There was one message. "Hi, Kinsey. This is Ash. Listen, I talked to my mother yesterday about this business with Lance, and she'd like to meet with you if that's okay. Give me a call when you get in and we'll set something up. Maybe this afternoon sometime, if that works for you. Thanks. Talk to you soon. Bye." I tried the number at the house, but the line was busy. I changed into my jeans and made myself some lunch. By the time I got through to Ash, her mother was resting and couldn't be disturbed, but I was invited to tea at 4 o'clock. I decided to drive up the pass to the gun club and practice target shooting with the little .32 I keep locked in my top desk drawer in an old sock. I shoved the gun, clip, and a box of 50 cartridges into a small canvas duffel and tucked it in the trunk of my car. I stopped for gas, and then headed north on 101 to the junction of 154, following the steep road that zigzags up the mountainside. The day was chilly. We'd had several days of unexpected rain, and the vegetation was a dark green, blending in the distance to an intense navy blue. The clouds overhead were a cottony white with ragged underpinnings, like the torn lining on the underside of an old box spring. As the road ascended, fog began to mass and dissipate, traffic slowing to accommodate the fluctuating visibility. I downshifted twice and pulled the heater on. At the summit, I turned left onto a secondary road barely two lanes wide, which angled upward, twisting half a mile into backcountry. Massive boulders, mantled in dark green moss, lined the road, where the overhanging trees blocked out the sun. The trunks of the live oaks were frosted with fungus the color of a greened-out copper roof. I could smell heather and bay laurel, and the frail scent of wood smoke drifting from the cabins tucked in along the ridge. Where the roadside dropped away, the canyons were blank with fog. The wide gate to the gun club was open, and I drove the last several hundred yards, pulling into the gravel parking lot, deserted except for a lone station wagon. Aside from the man in charge, I was the only person there. I paid my $4 and followed him down to the cinder block shed that housed the restrooms. He opened a padlock to the storage room and extracted an oblong of cardboard mounted on a piece of lathing with a target stapled to it.
"Visibility might be tough now in this fog," he warned.
"I'll chance it," I said. He eyed me with misgiving, but finally handed over the target, a staple gun, and two additional targets. I hadn't been up to the practice range for months, and it was nice to have the whole place to myself. The wind had picked up, and mist was being blown across concrete bunkers like something in a horror movie. I set up the target at a range of 25 yards. I inserted soft plastic earplugs, and then put on hearing protectors over them. All outside noises were damped down to a mild hush, my breathing audible in my own head as though I were swimming. I loaded 8 cartridges into the clip of my .32 and began to fire. Each round sounded like a balloon popping somewhere close by, followed by the characteristic whiff of gunpowder I so love. I moved up to the target and checked to see where I was hitting. High and left. I circled the first 8 holes with a magic marker, then went back to the bench rest and loaded the gun again. A sign just behind me read, "Guns as we use them here are a source of pleasure and entertainment, but one moment of carelessness or foolishness can bring it all to an end forever." Amen, I thought. The hard-packed dirt just in front of me was as littered with shells as a battlefield. I saved my brass, collecting the casings after each firing, tucking them neatly back into the styrofoam brick that cradled the live rounds. By 3:15 I was cold, and most of my ammunition was gone. I can't claim that my little semi-automatic is wildly accurate at 25 yards, but at least I was feeling connected to the process again. Chapter 8. At 3:55 I was turning into the circular drive to the Wood family home, located on 7 acres of land that sat on the bluffs overlooking the Pacific. Their fortunes on the rise, they'd moved since I'd last visited. This house was enormous, done in a French Baroque style, a 2-story central structure flanked by 2 prominent tower wings. The stucco exterior was as smooth and white as frosting on a wedding cake, roofline and windows edged with plaster garlands, rosettes, and shell motifs that might have been piped out of a pastry tube. A brick walk led from the driveway around to the seaward-facing front of the house, and up 2 steps to a wide, uncovered brick porch. A series of arched French doors spanned the façade, which curved outward around a conservatory on one end and a gazebo on the other. A heavy black woman in a white uniform admitted me. I followed her, like a stray pup, across a foyer tiled in black and white marble squares.
"Mrs. Wood asked if you'd wait in the morning room," the maid said without pausing for a reply. She departed on thick crepe soles that made no sound on the polished parquet floors.
"Oh, sure," I thought. "That's where I usually hang out at my place."
The morning room, where else?
The walls were